There's no free lunch when it comes to investing. But what about a podcast that delivers educational content on investing, financial planning, items of interest, and even the odd wacky topic? Welcome to the Free Lunch Podcast, hosted by Canvas Wealth. Free Lunch will bring listeners the team's vast knowledge and experience in dealing with uncertainty. Learn more and subscribe today at canvaswealth.ca.
Welcome back to the Free Lunch Podcast with Greg and Colin today. Greg, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Nice to be back.
Nice to have you. You've had a bit of an adventure recently.
Well, almost an adventure.
Yeah.
So, yes, we were among the many people who were planning to travel to Puerto Vallarta. And 1 week before we were scheduled to leave, there was this bit of violence of Mexican cartels down in Puerto Vallarta. And we still had a week before we had to travel, but we decided that we would just pass on this trip. You know, and things probably would have worked out.
You know,
there was two other couples that we were supposed to be meeting, and they went down and had a lovely time. But we just didn't feel like the risk maybe was worth it.
Well, I guess that's what we're talking about today is risk, reward, volatility, right?
Well, and it got me thinking about, you know, that rascal Blaise Pascal.
That's a whole mouthful. Rascal Blaise Pascal.
So Blaise Pascal, and there will be a connection here.
Okay.
Blaise Pascal, for people who are not familiar, and in all honesty, I wasn't familiar until I did a little research. Blaise Pascal was a French mathematician, a physicist, an inventor, and a religious philosopher from the 17th century. So he lived from 1623, only lived to the ripe old age of 39.
Yeah.
But in those 39 years, he laid the foundation for probability theory, things like Pascal's triangle, which you may not remember, but we learned in school.
I do not remember it, unfortunately. Should I admit that?
No, that's okay.
Yeah.
The Pascal's triangle, let me describe it.
Yeah.
It's like a triangle with numbers in it. The top number is one, and then the two numbers below it are one and one. And then you add the two numbers in each successive layer of the triangle as it gets wider. So then the next row is 1331 and 14641, that kind of thing.
You're just showing off your education now.
Well, you'd recognize it if you saw it.
Okay.
He also conducted some groundbreaking experiments on atmospheric pressure. And in fact, the unit of pressure, the Pascal, obviously is named after him.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And in fact, he invented one of the first mechanical calculators. Hmm. He did all this by the time he was 39.
You know, that's amazing because, you know, I think about life expectancy back then. And,
yeah.
You know, obviously people didn't live as long as they do now. And what did you do when you were 39?
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Did you invent something?
Well, you didn't. You don't know this, possibly, but I actually, there is a law that I developed as well, the Kreminsky's Law.
Well, you've mentioned it, but
yeah.
Can you share?
Sure. Kreminsky's Law basically states everything in moderation except for the things you really like. It's probably not too groundbreaking and hasn't been talked about a lot, but yeah, it's an important law and one I try to live by.
Sure.
So why is this Pascal relevant to this discussion about going to Puerto Vallarta? Well, Pascal created something because he was a religious philosopher as well, and he did embrace later in life the Catholic religion, but he came up with what they call Pascal's wager. Mm-hmm. And basically, the philosophical argument that he came up with says this: if you believe in God and God exists, then you gain eternal happiness in mm-hmm. heaven. And if you don't believe in God and God exists, then you risk eternal punishment in hell.
It's quite a trade-off.
It is. And if God doesn't exist, then whether you believed or not, there's really a limited impact on the future. Mm-hmm. So for him, the concept was, well, if you take little risk and you have the potential for almost unlimited reward, then that's better than not taking a little risk or risking eternal, you know, punishment.
Yeah.
So that actually, as it turns out, it laid the groundwork for a lot of probability theory, everything that insurance is based on, all that. Mm-hmm. So it becomes a question of, well, what is a risk worth taking? And what's the potential reward based on the amount of risk you have to take? And so that ties back to the whole Puerto Vallarta discussion because, well, you know, risk of cartel violence has always been in Mexico for the last, you know, decades.
Yeah.
But it only became apparent how risky it is when something actually happens close to home or close to where you're planning to travel.
Mm-hmm.
And so for us, it's like, well, now that the risk is apparent, maybe it's better not to travel to Mexico. There's lots of hot countries we could visit. We can go to Hawaii, you can go to the Caribbean, where that the risk of cartel violence is not as big.
Yeah.
So that was a decision we made. It's kind of a probability-based decision, but it also ties into investment risk, you know, and it's one of the things that we talk about a lot, which is, okay, well, what are risks worth taking? And what's the downside of taking certain other risks? You know, we talk about it a lot. Diversification is one of the things that fits most, you know, most closely to.
Yeah.
So anyway, so there you go. Blaise Pascal and going to Puerto Vallarta.
Interesting to me because I hate to say this out loud to anybody listening, but I was in the United States,
right,
with my wife, mm-hmm. as you know. And I had a lot of people around me that avoided the United States because of geopolitical reasons.
Sure.
Only to go to Mexico instead and be trapped in Puerto Vallarta because of a cartel war.
Exactly.
So,
yeah. So which of those risks is greater, going to Mexico or going to the U.S.?
Yeah, yeah. We're not going to solve that right now.
No.
But how does, as you say, it does relate to investing, and where I see it right now is what's going on with what's happening recently with the U.S. and Iran. Do you say Iran or Iran?
I say Iran.
Iran.
Yeah.
What's the correct pronunciation?
I'm not really sure.
Because they'll say like Iranian.
I don't think it's Iran. Like, I think people that say Iran are probably offending Iranians.
Okay. Could be. So sorry if that's what's coming across here. But this geopolitical risk and volatility is being played out in the markets today. And where we wanted to go with this was, remember the Monday after the U.S. attacked Iran?
Yeah, sure.
And the U.S. markets actually closed up a little bit.
They did.
Which is really hard to rationalize, mm-hmm. right? Because you think with war that there would be some sort of fallout in markets.
You'd expect that.
Now, that fallout happened a day later,
yeah.
right? Where the Dow opened up down, I don't know, 2.5% at the open.
Yeah.
But then even by the close, it only closed down less than 1%.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess that's where we're going today is like, you know, we're talking about geopolitical risk and war and all these things that have happened in the past. And we've touched on this stuff previously.
We right? have, yeah.
But we wanted to dig in a bit more today, right?
Well, let's do that.
Okay, well, you take us away because I'm
behind. Well, so let's start with the obvious. So you just mentioned that when the news broke about the U.S.-Iran strikes, the markets reacted pretty quickly. And I guess maybe you'd expect that, but as you say, the outcome was not exactly what we expected. So what was the first thing to happen when the news of the war broke out? Well, and the first thing was oil prices moved.
Yeah, they surged like 10%.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's not surprising because Iran, you know, controls the Strait of Hormuz, where 20% of the world's oil passes through. Mm-hmm. And so it's obvious that people might expect, okay, well, there's going to be a big impact on oil prices, on anything else that travels through that strait.
Right.
And so investors start thinking, okay, if oil prices spike, markets must be in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but as you say, what happened? Well, in the end, despite an initial big sell-off on, as you say, the 2 days after the strikes, the markets ended up finishing not too badly. And those people concerned were right. Oil prices did spike.
Yeah.
But it didn't have the same impact on the overall market that people might have expected.
Well, and I've had a number of people reach out to me because we did send out something the day that the market went down 2.5% at the open. And it was a volatility note to clients.
Yep.
And unfortunately, what it led to is I did get a couple of emails from people saying, should we be taking advantage of this volatility?
Right.
But it was intraday volatility, right? So just because it opened up that way doesn't mean that it closed that way. And I don't know how you take advantage of that, especially with securities that are priced once a day.
That's right. It's very hard, you know, to capitalize on something that's instantaneous like that.
Yeah.
You know, and when we look back to other sort of global events, even like the pandemic, even when the markets went down 35%, mm-hmm. it still happened very quickly. It doesn't leave you a lot of time to be nimble, as they might say, and adjust your portfolio.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about markets during war in general then, because we've got lots of history around this, right?
Yep.
You know, war is not a new thing, unfortunately. It's not something that we, you know, advocate for, of course, but there's this misunderstanding of what happens when it comes to volatility in equity markets specifically during times of war. And you can go back to World War II, right? From 1939 to 1945, the Dow Jones actually rose about 50% during the war.
Yeah, which is kind of incredible when you think about the scale of that conflict. I mean, it was a world war.
Yeah. So, it doesn't get worse than that.
No, that's right.
Right? And so now we're talking about regional conflicts. They are regional right now.
Yes.
Right? Unfortunately, nobody's talking about Ukraine and Russia right now because all the focus is on the U.S. Iran issue.
That's true.
People aren't talking about the Epstein files right now, but that's a whole other episode.
Exactly.
So
we may or may not want to go down that path.
Yeah, yeah. But other examples, I mean, the Korean War in the early 50s, the S&P 500 actually was up 18% during the conflict.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, that's kind of crazy to think about.
Yep.
Right?
Move forward to the Gulf War in 1990. You know, there was a strong initial reaction. The markets dropped about 16%. But once the war actually began and uncertainty cleared, the market rallied and finished up 26% in 1991.
Amazing.
Yeah. Even the Iraq War in 2003, S&P finished that year up 28%. So you see a similar pattern there.
I think the pattern is that the market doesn't really care about war that much.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And this is sort of hard to rationalize as a human being who I hope lives a life full of morals, right, is that the market, unfortunately, seems only to care about corporate earnings.
Yeah, to some people, it seems rather cynical.
Yeah.
You know, that how can the market just shrug off, wars and destruction and soldiers and innocent civilians getting killed and that kind of thing?
Well, because markets price uncertainty more than they price bad news is basically what it comes down to. And that's just the way it is. I mean, markets are always looking forward. They're looking forward, 6 to 12 months ahead and saying, okay, great, that's what's happening right now. But what does the next 2 to 4 quarters look like?
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. And when you look at what's happening, whether it's a war or anything else, once investors start to understand the scope of the situation, then the uncertainty that markets despise kind of falls away. And then the markets, as you say, just focus on things that matter, like earnings, earnings growth, and things like that.
Now, one thing we haven't talked about, and it wasn't in our script notes, so I'm going to go a little off script, was inflation linked to the price of oil, right? Oil is highly inflationary during this type of event.
Yep.
And that's already being felt at the gas pumps, like immediately.
Yeah.
Right? Which goes counter to what the current president of the United States was trying to accomplish before this. Going into a midterm election, I'm not sure how that's going to play out.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, while we're not political scientists or experts on this kind of thing, but there does seem to be a lot of conflicting objectives with regards to, some of the various activities that are being undertaken. So,
yeah. Well, how does it relate to Canada and the U.S.?
Sure. Well, the dynamics are a little bit different here. The S&P 500 has historically delivered around 10% annual returns over the long term and about 12 to 13% annually over the last decade. So it's been a really great decade.
Yeah.
The TSX Composite, on the other hand, roughly 9% long-term returns, but closer to 7 to 8% over the past decade. And the biggest difference is just the structure and the sector exposure of our markets.
Yeah.
If you look at Canada, heavily weighted towards energy, financials, and materials, commodities. And the U.S. market has much more exposure to technology, healthcare, and consumer innovation.
Yeah, I'm running into an issue with this one because I had a client reach out to me recently. In their portfolio, we hold our model portfolio, which is, less than 3% Canadian equities.
Yes.
And they keep asking me, why don't we have the heavier Canadian exposure because of where oil's at?
Yep.
And the hard part, and maybe you can help me with this live here, Greg.
Sure.
The hard part I'm having with this one is that I can look back historically and say, well, we have this 3% exposure to Canada because, as you say, Canada is so linked to energy and banks.
Yep.
And right now, energy just happens to be up.
Right.
But it hasn't always been like that, and we want to have a more globally diversified portfolio to smooth out returns.
Right.
But it's hard to dispute the evidence from the last 5 years that shows that the TSX actually has done better than the U.S. markets.
Of course, so have international markets.
Yeah.
If you look at their performance last year, and so a globally market-weighted portfolio, yes, will be underweight. It won't be underweight. It'll be appropriately weighted to Canada on the world stage. But it doesn't mean there's no exposure to oil. I mean, there's other countries that'd be reflected in the international sort of portion of the portfolio that do have exposure to oil.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, doesn't every country need
sure.
oil?
Sure. I mean, and even the U.S., I mean, there's, you know, there are some fairly big oil companies trading in the U.S., Exxon, and a variety of others. And so I think the thing is that it's such a cyclical industry or sector, and you really don't know when that sector is going to do so well.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, if you look at back, I mean, oil tanked, you know, the year of COVID with global shutdowns, you know, and oil tanked. And, you know, from a timing perspective, you could say, well, maybe that was an ideal time to load up on energy.
Yeah.
And it probably was.
Yeah.
But you didn't have to. You did really well just by staying in the markets or reallocating bonds or cash to equities in general.
Right.
So it's true that, you know, you're going to go through periods where oil and other commodities may have a really great run, but it's very difficult to predict when. And as I say, when you've got other countries that make up a good part of the international exposure, you're picking up that exposure anyway, that oil exposure,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether it's, you know, Norwegian stocks, you know, or companies like Shell, you know, I think, which is a Dutch company. I think the answer is yes, you get it, you know, and I think that's just, you know, if you looked at just global market returns over the last 50, 60 years, you'd be quite happy just to get those returns.
Well, that's the part I'm having a hard time with this one particular client, because yes, the TSX has performed better in the last few years than our globally diversified portfolio. But then it just becomes another function of market timing.
Exactly.
Right? Because, okay, you could say, well, the TSX has performed better for the last 5 years, so the chances of it continuing to perform better over the next 5 years would be less than the globally diversified portfolio.
Yeah, it could be, for sure. And because you've got, you know, it's always the fear, well, if peace breaks out, then oil prices will go back to normal. You know, I believe the Saudis already have agreed to increase production, you know, to make sure that the world gets the oil it needs, and that should help offset any disruptions in the Strait of Hormuz.
Okay, let's get back on script here. We wanted to talk about the real risk during volatility.
Right? Yeah, sure.
Do you want to take that one?
Sure. The uncomfortable truth is that the biggest risk during volatile markets isn't the market, it's actually the investor.
Yeah, this is a hard one for people to understand. Even going back to this conversation I'm having with this one particular client, is that markets have great returns.
Yes.
And if you just got market returns, as you say, over the last 50, 60 years, you'd be pretty happy.
Yep.
The problem is that that's a dumb thing to say.
Average.
So the average
yes.
investor actually underperforms the market by 3-4% per year, according to data from Dalbar. So then you got to question, well, why is that?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And it's not because they picked bad investments,
yeah.
because this kind of research has been available for years, you know, that many investors underperform the funds, investment funds or mutual funds that they actually invest in.
Yeah.
And so the only way that can happen is if the investor does not stay invested.
Yeah.
And it's because they react emotionally. And there's a tendency to sell during downturns and buy back after the markets recover, because mm-hmm. it's a feeling of comfort versus a feeling of discomfort.
Yeah.
And when markets are volatile, people feel uncomfortable and are more likely to think that they need to make a change. Everybody looks back to when things are really bad, and they look back wistfully as if, wow, that would have been such a great time to invest.
Yeah.
And everyone was totally panicked at that time.
Yeah.
So volatility ends up becoming a behavioral problem rather than an investment problem.
Yeah.
And so it's just a matter of how to survive.
I won't say his name, but it doesn't really matter. He's a good guy. I really like him. And in March of 2025, he moved to cash.
Oh, yeah.
Because he was scared.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nothing that we could say or do, no evidence that we could provide that could stop him from moving to cash. We tried our best.
Yeah.
And he's been sitting in cash for a year.
Yep.
Well, what's happened in that year is he's missed incredible returns.
Yeah.
And so now he's sitting there and I'm sure he's wondering, well, when to get back in?
Yep.
Right? And listen, at some point, he's probably going to be right in that markets will trade off and maybe there's an opportunity to get back in.
Yep.
But it's really hard to miss out on 20 plus rates of return.
And you know what? When markets do unusual things, and again, I kind of go back to the global pandemic as an example, because that's one of those things that was brand new.
Yeah.
You know, for us or for anyone in the last 100 years. I think back to those old lines from the movies where somebody says, "We're all scared, kid." And anyone that says they ain't scared is a damn liar. Because even as professionals in the investment industry, it was hard not to be scared. I mean,
sure.
We're facing something that we've never faced in our lives before. The entire global economy shut down. And so even, you know, the most diehard long-term investor, you know, would be a little bit rattled by what's going on.
Yeah.
But the secret is you have to expect volatility.
Yeah.
Because there's always going to be something that causes the markets to be volatile. Typically, you know, markets go through a 10 to 15% drop almost every year at some point.
Yeah.
You know, even in strong years, you know, and you look at last year, 2025, with the Liberation Day.
Yeah.
I mean, the markets went down almost 20%. You know, the S&P was down about 20%.
Yeah.
Still finished strong, but that was a pretty scary day.
It was.
And that's about as long as it lasted.
It's funny. Everybody has high risk tolerance when markets are up.
Yep.
And then when markets trade off, which they do, as you say, you use the word cyclical.
Yep.
I like to say cyclical.
Okay.
Which one's right?
I'm not sure. They both could be right.
I like saying cyclicality for some reason.
Yeah.
The cyclicality of equity markets.
Okay.
You say the cyclicality.
True.
Now, do you say finance or finance?
I say finance.
Yeah. But I kind of like the way finance sounds.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. You say finance and what was the other one we were talking about?
Cyclicality.
Cyclicality, and I'll say Iran.
Okay. All
I'm
right.
Not sure how that fits in, but
I don't know.
There you go.
Well, let's finish off this episode with some practical advice for people because we're experiencing a lot of volatility. You can measure volatility. You can look at the VIX if you want.
Yep.
But all it's really telling you is what's happened.
Yes.
It's not telling you what's going to happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing, as you mentioned earlier, was just to expect volatility, both upside and downside.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And that you're right. 9 out of 10 years, the stock market falls 10% during the course of a year.
Yeah.
So that's not unusual,
mm-hmm.
right? But what should people do to offset that?
You should diversify globally, you know, which we've just been talking about. Canada represents only about 3% of the global equity market. And so diversification reduces risk. And getting back to Pascal's wager, it doesn't cost any more to diversify globally than it does to invest either only in your own domestic market or worse yet, in a few individual stocks.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the downside of that investment, you know, could be much greater. You know, we've talked in the past, if you buy a single stock, you could either get rich or you could lose everything.
Mm-hmm.
And losing everything is such a dire outcome that most people would choose not to do that.
Yeah.
And so the more broadly diversified the portfolio is, the more chance there is of getting a reasonable outcome and limiting the downside, which is what most people want to do.
Yeah. And focus on the long term. I was just talking to somebody yesterday and they said that their mom lost $500,000 during the global financial crisis.
Yep.
So I said to them, well, did they sell?
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I'm not sure, but it sounds like she'd never recovered it. I said, well, then she sold.
Yep.
So even during that monumental time in our lives and our careers, we were still focused on keeping people invested.
Yeah.
Because if you stayed invested, not only did you have full recovery, but you're actually up 700 or 800% since then.
Right.
Right?
Exactly.
But it took a lot of courage to stay invested. So really focus on the long term. What are your goals, right?
Yep, absolutely. And next is you've got to ignore the headlines. I mean, we're all, speaking for myself, I'm a news junkie. I tend to read the news and maybe too much because The headlines are intended to draw people in. The headlines never say, don't worry, this has happened before, everything will be fine. Mm-hmm. It'll focus on where the bombs dropped, how many people have been killed, and that kind of thing, how much oil prices have moved up. And that's not going to help. That just amplifies the fear.
Yep. And so the last thing we'd say to that is, and I already kind of said it, is stay invested.
Yeah.
You know, it's some of the biggest positive market returns happen right after the worst declines. And we've done all the data. We've looked at all this data for years, you know, like if you missed the 10 best days or the best month or the best year or whatever.
Yep.
There's dramatic results.
Yep, exactly. I mean, markets have survived an incredible number of crises over the last century. And in fact, as we think about it, just over the last 20 or 30 years, we've gone through a lot. The lessons are pretty simple. You know, volatility is uncomfortable, but it's totally normal and expected.
Yep.
And the investors who succeed aren't the ones that try to predict the markets perfectly, but they're the ones that stay disciplined when everybody else is reacting emotionally.
Yeah, so let's just wrap it up with stay diversified and stay invested.
Right on.
Maybe find something else that brings you joy if you're worried about it, right?
Exactly.
You know, I fear, you know, we're coming into spring.
Yep.
Gardening's right around the corner.
There you go.
Or, I don't know, what other things do people do in spring? Golf is right around the corner.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Although golf doesn't always bring me joy.
Well.
Sometimes it does.
It does overall.
It does overall.
It's kind of like the markets. You may not be happy with every day, but overall, you know, at the end of a season, you're happy.
For sure. Yeah. For sure.
There
yeah.
you go.
All right.
Till next time then.
Thank you for listening to the Free Lunch Podcast hosted by Canvas Wealth. To subscribe to this podcast to get more realistic insights on investing or to connect with one of our talented partners, please head on over to canvaswealth.ca. We'll see you next time on the Free Lunch Podcast.
Financial planning services are offered through Canvas Wealth. Portfolio management services are provided by Q Wealth Partners, a registered portfolio manager, investment fund manager, and exempt market dealer. Canvas is an owner and partner in the Q Wealth Partnership. The information discussed in this show, including any opinion, is based on various sources believed to be reliable, but subject to change. The opinions expressed in this show are opinions of the individuals, and they have not been approved by and are not necessarily those of Q Wealth as a firm. This is not legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice and should not be relied as such.